With the elections behind us, mainstream media attention has turned away from the endless lines at some polling places, from reduced early voting options in predominantly urban districts, and from other obstacles we saw placed in the way of many voters in the election, already complicated in the Northeast by the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. The cable news channels, meantime, have gone all Petraeus all the time. But according to my first guest today, it's going to take every day of the next 4 years to untangle the obstacle courses that have been set up to make voting much more difficult for a select segment of Americans. You heard me right, to make voting more difficult. Since he was last on the show, investigative journalist and author Greg Palast has returned yet again to the New York Times bestseller list with his provocatively titled book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. He spent the week of the election at ground zero of swing state mania in Dayton and Toledo, Ohio. He was a great guest the first time. I'm glad he's back. Greg, congratulations on the success of your book, and welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton, but I'll consider the book successful when the billionaires and ballot bandits stop shoplifting our elections.
Good. That's a very good segue to the first question. You were in Dayton covering the Souls to the Polls initiative on the Sunday prior to Election Day. I wish you would talk about what you saw and the significance of the new limits being placed on early voting.
Well, it's very serious. I flew into Ohio and went to Dayton on a tip that there was monkey business with the balloting in Ohio, the swing state. Now, people have to understand that votes are controlled, and whether they're counted, whether you're on the voter rolls, that's always controlled by your Secretary of State in your state. And unfortunately, in America, they're usually very partisan officials like Catherine Harris, who was both Secretary of State of Florida in 2000 and head of the Bush reelection campaign in 2004. The Secretary of State of Ohio was also head of the Bush reelection campaign. This time we had a partisan Republican official. The effect was that there was an obstacle course, as you properly put it, placed in front of African American voters and Latino voters. Now, how does that happen? As a practical matter, blacks and whites vote on different days in Ohio. This is for the past dozen years. So white voters tend to vote on the official Tuesday election day. Black voters, African Americans, vote almost completely early and usually on the Sunday before, after church. They call it Souls to the Polls, where people go to church, pile into the church van, and then take off for the polls. What happened this time is that early voting days were reduced from 4 Sundays before Election Day to a single Sunday, from 8 hours to 4 hours, and from dozens of polls per county to one single polling place per county. That's including Cleveland with 1.5 million people, or where I was in Dayton with about 500,000 people. One single polling place. The result was, when I followed one church group, the Freedom Faith Missionary Baptist Church in Dayton to the polls, they got in line behind 1,000 people waiting to vote. 1,000 people. That's not my estimate. The official in charge of the vote said, yeah, it's about 1,000 now, about 3,000 to 4,000 coming through altogether in a 4-hour period. Well, of course, you end up without a 4-hour period. If they get there within 4 hours, they're given a number and they can wait 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. In Cleveland, it went up to midnight when the polls closed at 5. That meant 7 hours wait for some people, almost all African Americans. Then they got to the front of the line. I went with the group, with the Missionary Baptist group, and they were not handed ballots as the law required. They were handed applications for absentee ballots. They had to fill those out, hand those in another line, get an absentee ballot, fill those out, hand those in another line. And without realizing, of course, that in America, and this is true for every absentee ballot, about a fourth of absentee ballots are thrown out, up to about 3 million absentee ballots are thrown out in any election. And that was at least the number lost in this presidential election. So a lot of those votes, after waiting all those hours, won't be counted. So that's how things have changed.
Greg, let me back up, and I want to know a little bit about what you saw and heard before the people got in that line. In other words, in the churches in the African American community, was the moral imperative that people heard related to the almost sacred ritual of exercising the right to vote, or did it have to do with voting for a specific candidate?
Well, that's one of the things that shocked me and surprised me, you know, because I was just at a white church, a white evangelical church in the same town north of Dayton, very upscale, all these SUVs and Mercedes in the parking lot in the new church. They would vote on the Tuesday when there'd be 176 polling places in Montgomery. And they were filled with all kinds of literature promoting the Romney candidacy and the Republican candidates for Senate and other offices. When I went to the black church, which is a very poor community, there were no Obama signs, no literature suggesting how you vote, no kind of fake comparisons, which pretend to be nonpartisan but are partisan. There was no discussion by the minister of whom you should vote for. It was all about, this is what we do as a matter of faith. This is what we do as a vocation and an obligation to our community, to ourselves, and they put it as an obligation to God. I was really taken aback by the, and quite surprised by their approach, but they were absolutely committed to the concept that it is voting, and it's a kind of trial. They kind of prepared people for the fact that you may wait in the cold, and it was very cold, you may wait in the cold for hours. You may have your vote rejected. You may have all kinds of trouble finding your registration or trouble from the voting authorities, but you're going to vote. And that's all they cared about. And even when I asked a couple of the people in line, are you ready to wait in the cold hours? Yes. Who are you going to vote for? Not going to tell you. It's my business. And it was all about voting as an action, because this is a kind of sacred opportunity that Americans have, and that black people have won through great struggle. So it had nothing to, it really had nothing to do with the candidates, though obviously they have an overwhelming preference.
My guest is best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast. His latest book is Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. And we're talking about moral components of voting and of voter suppression. Greg, you also were in Toledo, Ohio on Election Day. What with your own eyes and ears did you experience that day?
Well, I went out with my cameraman to see how the voting was done in a white suburb. And, you know, I was expecting to film short lines. We didn't see any short lines. There were no lines. There was a line of poll workers lining up to help the voters. There were about 3 poll workers per voter. It was all inside a Lutheran church, very warm, no waiting in the cold, and they even served coffee. It was very friendly and very nice, and people were given, they didn't have to apply to vote. They were just immediately given ballots, which were in fact put into optical scanners and counted on the spot.
Hang on just a second, because I want to interrupt you, because you just described voting early in a primarily African-American community, and you said they got other materials to fill out before they could vote.
Yes. In fact, I actually rushed off in the middle of the night to wake up a law professor, Robert Fetrakis, professor of law and voting rights expert in Columbus, Ohio, to say, is this normal? Is this correct? And he said, no, he was shocked. He was ready to, he suited up to go before a judge in the morning. Of course, it'd be too late. But he was stunned that voters were not given, as required by law, ballots, but they were given an application for a ballot. And what he was concerned with, as I was.
But that wasn't happening in Toledo. That wasn't happening in the white community.
No, the white communities got ballots. Even on early voting in the rural communities, there were no lines. And there were a few places where there is some souls to the polls voting in white communities by evangelicals, though usually they waited till the Tuesday. And in the rural communities, they were given regular ballots, counted on the spot, no lines. So we really have what the professor called a new Jim Crow system that's developing in a few states like Ohio and like Florida, where you also saw the lines.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dangerous business.
Yeah, and am I wrong, or was there really no major report about this in the mainline press?
No, I mean, well, there was, yes, absolutely, in the mainline press in Europe, London, Italy, Germany, South America. This was top news. My reports were being carried all over the world, and there were other reporters from around the world. But the American news reporters avoided this somewhat at all costs. There are a few films taken of long lines, right, especially on election night in Florida. But basically, we couldn't get anyone, for example, to even consider this issue of why are black people given basically a different type of ballot, a more risky ballot that may not get counted, when white people are given a different ballot.
And that
we couldn't get anyone to pick this up.
And that couldn't have happened, could it, without the Secretary of State knowing that?
Well, in fact, the voting manager in Montgomery County was very, very unhappy because he told me he was ordered to take this position. And when two Democrats, they have a bipartisan panel in the county running the voting, objected, they were removed by the Secretary of State because he said, you're defying my orders on early voting. Mm. They were very concerned about a line of 1,000 people. And the manager, I will say, the local people running the polling were very upset that they had to run people through this gauntlet, have people out in the parking lots. They were trying their best, but they were ordered by state partisan politicians to play this game or lose their jobs.
Is there a way that communities of faith can take a more active role in protecting the voting rights of the members of their congregations, regardless of their political affiliation?
Yeah, I think that we need to have a common commitment, no matter your religion or race, that every vote in America should count. This is a commitment that was put in front of us by Martin Luther King. In fact, I got the name of this church through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Mm-hmm.
You are always going to have the churches, especially in the African American and Latino communities, at the forefront of the civil rights fight. And the more a kind of community organizing, the better. In fact, one of the reasons why Ohio, whether you're for or against Mr. Obama, mattered is that because people went to church first, no one, and I say no one, left those lines. They came in prepared morally.
Mm-hmm.
They came in prepared as a, vocationally, to take on this challenge. It wasn't like in the Toledo suburbs where you kind of, oh, yeah, I think I'll go out and vote after work, or, oh, yeah, is there a line there? I'll wait a few minutes. Yeah. It was nothing like that. This was they went in the church bus, they came back together in the church bus, and no one was leaving in between.
Yeah. You know, what strikes me about that is so sad that there are two stereotypes here. One about the equality of voting in all precincts, and everything happens just the same way. And you saw that was wrong. That didn't happen. And then we hear the stereotype that the real politicking from a faith-based perspective comes in the black church. You experienced it primarily in the white church. Is that right?
Yes, in the white church, it was like I walked out with armfuls of literature and material, basically supporting the Republican ticket. You know, and they had party officials in this big giant church. I mean, it was, by the way, I just picked it randomly. I just saw an evangelical church and I stopped in. Yeah. And but in the black churches, it was very different. They just they wanted to get across the idea that what is sacred here is not who gets elected, but that you take a voting position.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that when I was in Florida with Reverend Jesse Jackson and at some of the black mega churches, there was some discussion of politics indirectly.
Sure. Yeah.
But it was a debate because the churches were split at the time, and because there was a lot of issues over gay rights within the black community 4 years ago or 8 years ago. And so there was, there was a kind of literally a debate between the pastors taking different positions. Yes. So it was a kind of discussion, not proselytizing for a party.
You know, I wish that we could talk about every page in this book. So listeners, I want you to pay careful attention to what I'm going to say, because I haven't had any other guest on the show that wrote a book that asked me to say this. But Greg Palast's investigative book, his latest New York Times bestseller book, is titled Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. And Greg, as I understand it, you're giving away, for a limited period of time, you're giving away electronic copies of this book free online. Is that right?
That's correct, because the book, unlike most books, is not published for profit. It's published by my not-for-profit foundation. It's a nonpartisan book. It's a nonprofit book, and we decided that, you know, if it's in the public interest, we love it that thousands, tens of thousands of people have purchased the book and put on the Times list, and that's great. It supports the foundation. But I think the important thing is that people get the information on how they steal the election, also how to protect your vote, which is at the end of the book. And so we just made a decision. If you want the book, we think it's really important. Take a look. And that way you can also say, you know, you don't have to spend, even though it's cheap, paperback, you don't have to spend money to say, well, do I like this? Does it make sense to me? You could just kind of take a look at it. And it's, by the way, it has a full color comic book in the middle to make it fun.
Well, can you tell the host of this show how I can get to that?
Absolutely. You can go to www.gregpalast.com. That's GREGPALAST.com. Or this will be easier to remember. www.ballotbandits.org. Ballotbandits.org.
This is really staggering to me, because I get the impression, which surely is not true, that you didn't write the book to make a profit on it. You did it to actually do something good.
Well, it's a good thing I didn't write it to make a profit, because I was just informed that we're kind of a little bit in the red, despite it being an extreme a big bestseller.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we did a lot of research. We do a lot of traveling and communication. And at the back of the book, by the way, you'll see lots of organizations, nonpartisan organizations, which give you information on how to organize to protect your vote and deal with the issues that we deal with in the book, whether it's the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, People for the American Way, and other organizations and media groups that are backing this. So it's a book which is kind of the, I don't want to say the Bible here, but let's call it the, one of the books of the voter protection movement.
Listen, man, I love what you do. I love the attitude with which you do it. I'm grateful for you making that available. And, Greg, I wish you continued success in all of this kind of important work. I want you to be back with us soon on State of Belief Radio, and I thank you for being with us today.
And I really appreciate this opportunity. It's very special to be on your program, Elton.